ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Losing elimination status would be a blow because it signals that something's gone wrong with our public health system.
Measles were officially eliminated from the U.S. a quarter century ago. What are the long-term consequences now that measles are back?
For Tuesday, April 8th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump wants to increase deportations and reduce the size of the federal government.
We'll look at how that's affecting immigration judges.
For this president to campaign on deporting immigrants on the one hand, and then he turns around and fires the judges that are supposed to hear the cases on the other hand, it's a head scratcher.
Also, some Republicans in Congress are beginning to speak out against Trump's tariffs.
From my perspective, the Constitution, specifically Article 1, Section 8, is very clear that tariff responsibility lies with Congress.
And should you swap your human therapist for an AI bot?
That's ahead, First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Ahead of the imposition of, in some cases, double-digit tariffs, President Donald Trump today talked about asking some law firms he made deals with to provide pro bono help with negotiations. Trump's remarks coming as he signed executive actions aimed at reviving the coal industry. At the event, the president saying they're working on bespoke trade agreements with any country that wants to make a deal.
We're doing very well in making, I call them tailored deals, not off the rack. These are tailored, highly tailored deals. Right now, Japan is flying here to make a deal. South Korea is flying here to make a deal, and others are flying here.
Meanwhile, the looming trade tariffs led to more confusion on the part of world leaders, corporate CEOs, and investors. The broad market is now barely above a bear market, down 19% from the record set back in February. The IRS has reached agreement with immigration authorities to share tax information about some immigrants without legal status. NPR's Joel Rose reports this marks a major change in how tax records can be used.
In a court filing, a top IRS official shared a memorandum of understanding between the tax collector and U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement that was executed on Monday. Under the terms of the deal, ICE officers can ask the IRS for information about immigrants who have final orders of removal or are under criminal investigation. The court filing came in a lawsuit brought by immigrant advocacy groups that are seeking to block any information sharing between the IRS and ICE. Immigrants without legal status pay billions of dollars in taxes. Tax experts warn that the change could undermine immigrants' trust in the IRS, pushing them to seek jobs where they are paid under the table. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
The House of Representatives held a hearing today on U.S. competitiveness and artificial intelligence. NPR's Emily Fang reports House Democrats took the opportunity to criticize the Trump administration for canceling federal science and health grants and laying off thousands of government scientists.
Democratic lawmakers noted that while the U.S. says it prioritizes semiconductors and AI, it has also eliminated programs and funding that were set up to support related research. Luce Rivas is a California Democrat and an MIT-trained engineer.
Instead of uplifting this work in the national interest, this administration has cut federal funding for research and fired science staff.
At the hearing, there was bipartisan consensus that the U.S. needs to do more to incentivize innovation in artificial intelligence, especially in light of advances from Chinese companies. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington.
After days of heavy rain, swollen rivers are continuing to overflow their banks in parts of Kentucky. Floodwaters are slowly receding in Frankfort, Kentucky, with residents there hoping to return by late tomorrow. High river levels are just the latest threat from a series of storms that have killed at least 23 people in the South and Midwest. Stocks lost ground on Wall Street today. The Dow fell another 320 points. This is NPR. Three U.S. citizens convicted of participating in a failed coup attempt in the Democratic Republic of Congo have had their death sentences commuted to life in prison, and they are now being returned to the U.S. NPR's Emmanuel Akinwoto reports that it comes amid moves by the DRC to improve ties and negotiate a minerals deal with the U.S.
The three Americans convicted of a failed coup attempt last May will serve out their life sentences in the U.S., according to the DRC president's office. Tammy Bruce, a spokesperson for the U.S. State Department, said the government was aware of their transfer into U.S. custody. Among the three Americans was 22-year-old Marcel Malanga, the son of DRC opposition figure and coup leader Christian Malanga, who was killed in the coup attempt. Their repatriation comes amid negotiations between the DRC and the U.S. on a minerals deal in exchange for help fighting Rwanda-backed rebels that have seized territory in the east of the country. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News.
A NASA astronaut and two Russian cosmonauts have arrived at the International Space Station. The trio ferried there by a Russian spacecraft sent into orbit by a Soyuz rocket yesterday. Johnny Kim and the two Russians docking with the International Space Station earlier today as part of an 8-month mission. NASA says the U.S. astronaut will conduct scientific investigations and technology demonstrations to help prepare crews for future space missions. Crude oil futures prices continue to slide, reaching 4-year lows as inflation fears mount over a looming conflict between the world's two biggest economies, the U.S. and China. Oil fell $1.12 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ilsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. It's been 25 years since measles was officially eliminated from the United States. That's a technical term. In public health, it means measles has not had a steady 12-month spread. Right now, there are measles cases in several states. The biggest number is in West Texas, where two kids have died. To find out whether the U.S. can get this under control, we called Dr. Caitlin Rivers of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. She wrote a book called Crisis Averted about the history of public health victories. And I asked her what the U.S. needs to do to avert this crisis.
There are two things we need to see in order to get this crisis under control. One is clear and frequent communication. I think we could be doing better on that front. State and local communities are doing what they can to communicate, but I don't think that the messaging coming out of the federal government has been as clear as it needs to be about the importance of vaccination. The other thing that concerns me is funding and support for our public health infrastructure. The majority of Americans live in counties that spend less than $150 per year per person on public health. A single outbreak can really blow that budget for the year. And so if we are asking states and locals to take on more responsibility for outbreak control, we need to resource them to do that.
From your research on the book, is there a specific example of a public health victory that you think is especially useful here today?
My favorite is the example of the eradication of smallpox, which I think is one of history's and humanity's greatest achievements. Smallpox was an absolute horror. It killed up to a third of people it infected. Survivors were left often with lifelong disabilities. And through years of dedicated boots on the ground, community by community efforts to vaccinate, we drove that virus, the smallpox virus, off the face of the earth. And it has not circulated for 50 years. And what I love about that story is it really shows what we as a global community, as a public health community, can accomplish when we set our mind to these big goals and have the funding and the political support to go after them. And, you know, measles too, we successfully eliminated it. And I would hate to see that take a step backward.
You said messaging from the federal government isn't as clear as it needs to be. Of course, HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has a long history of vaccine skepticism. Earlier this week, he said the MMR vaccine is the most effective way to prevent the spread of measles. Do you think that message did what it needed to do?
I think we need to keep it coming. The information landscape is very fractured. People get their news from all sorts of places. They tune in, they tune out. And so reaching people is really about communicating frequently and clearly. And so I'm really heartened to hear that message from Secretary Kennedy, but I do think it needs to become a pattern or a cadence of that kind of messaging.
And on funding, we have seen widespread cuts across the government, including in the public health establishment. Do you think that is going to trickle down to states that need resources to fight measles outbreaks?
Absolutely. And I wouldn't be surprised if it already has. There were cuts to public health programs that directly affected states and local public health governments. They have had to lay off personnel as a direct result of those cuts. And I think we'll continue to see more. And I think as funding declines, we'll see more and more of these preventable outbreaks resurging.
Just to return to the question of whether a country is declared to have measles eliminated, if you've got children dying of the disease, if you have regular outbreaks, if you are not doing everything that could be done to fight this disease, why does it matter whether it is officially, formally declared to have been eliminated or not?
Well, we care most about what's happening on the ground. So as you know, the fact that there are children who are dying of this preventable infection and there are dozens of people who have been hospitalized, that's really the thing that matters. But elimination status is a reflection or a testament to our ability to control these preventable viruses. And so losing elimination status would be a blow because it signals that something's gone wrong with our public health system.
That's Dr. Caitlin Rivers from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Immigration judges are a little different from most judges. They actually work inside the executive branch at the Justice Department, not the judiciary. And they're the ones primarily responsible for making decisions on immigration law. They dictate, for example, whether someone should be allowed to remain in the U.S. or be required to leave. These judges and their staff are caught in the crosshairs of President Trump's twin efforts to increase deportations and reduce the size of the federal government. NPR's Ximena Bustillo has been following all of this. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
So, Ximena, when President Trump came into office, he wanted to enact this mass deportation plan. So tell us, where immigration judges fit into all of that?
Well, there are about 700 immigration judges nationwide. And when someone is placed into deportation proceedings, immigration judges hear their case. People get the chance to try and claim asylum or argue that there is a reason that they should not be deported. But for several presidencies, there has been a growing backlog of these cases, 4 million to be exact. Greg Chen from the American Immigration Lawyers Association says Congress has funded more law enforcement agents than they have judges.
And that number of cases of apprehensions are going into a court system that can't keep pace.
But immigration judges are pretty important here. They're the only ones that can do something like revoke a green card. They are also among the few who can grant asylum and grant protections from being deported. They can also officially approve a removal.
Okay, so as you point out, they are this really important part of the deportation process, which Trump says he wants to ramp up. But to kick off his term, he also fired more than 24 of these judges. Tell us more.
That's right. Within Trump's first month, he fired those judges, and over 100 people who work in immigration court in general had been fired or had accepted the so-called fork in the road option. You might remember this as the offer given to some federal employees to be paid through September if they agreed to resign. The people fired included judges as well as schedulers, lawyers, and interpreters. Immigration enforcement operations were excluded from staff cuts, hiring freezes, and they were not allowed to take this resignation offer. But that exclusion did not apply to judges. Matt Biggs, the president of the union that represents immigration judges, argues that these judges should have never been on the chopping block.
For this president to campaign on deporting immigrants on the one hand, and then he turns around and fires the judges that are supposed to hear the cases on the other hand, it's a head scratcher.
Neither DOJ nor the Office of Personnel Management responded to a request for comment on the firings.
So let me ask you this. Will not having enough judges hurt President Trump's goals of increasing deportations?
In short, yeah, it might. There are some high-profile cases of people who Trump deported without giving them a chance to go before an immigration judge. But most people still have to use the system. Lawyers and former judges told me that already each judge can hear between 500 to 700 cases a year. And that seems likely that the backlog will only grow. Here's Chen again.
And the fact that now we have a huge number of staff that are removed means that the courts are not going to be able to hear cases quickly or efficiently.
It can take a year to fully recruit, hire, and onboard a new judge. And that comes on top of the years that an asylum case, for example, may take to be litigated. And the Justice Department still has not opened the positions to backfill those who have been laid off.
NPR's Ximena Bustillo, thank you.
Thank you.
Therapy
is one of the new frontiers for artificial intelligence. A number of AI bots already on the market claim to offer mental health care, but some have dubious results or have even led people to self-harm. A recent study, however, suggests that given the right kind of training, AI therapy could be as effective or even better than human therapists in providing mental health care. NPR's Kadia Riddle reports.
There just aren't enough mental health professionals to go around. Nick Jacobson is a clinical psychologist and one of the researchers at Dartmouth College who worked on this project.
I think one of the things that unfortunately doesn't scale super well is humans.
For every 340 people in the U.S., there is just one mental health clinician. Jacobson and his colleagues thought, since we can't manufacture more human therapists, why not train an AI bot in the best therapeutic practices? Fast forward to today, after 5 years of work, they published the results of the first randomized clinical trial for an AI therabot in the New England Journal of Medicine.
The effects that we see in each of our outcomes strongly mirror what you would see in the best evidence-based trials of psychotherapy studies, with folks giving a gold standard dose of the best treatment we have available.
These researchers gathered a group of roughly 200 people who had diagnosable conditions like depression and anxiety, or were at risk of developing eating disorders. Half of them worked with AI therapy bots. Compared to those that did not receive treatment, they showed significant improvement.
So people were really developing this strong relationship with this, an ability to trust it and feel like they can work together on their mental health symptoms.
Another advantage of AI therapy, people could talk to their bots at all hours for as long as they wanted. The American Psychological Association has raised the alarm recently about the dangers of using unregulated AI therapy bots. But the association is pleased with this clinically trained and tested bot. Vale Wright is the director of the Office of Healthcare Innovation at the APA.
The Therabot in this study checks a bunch of the boxes that we have been hoping technologists would start to engage in. So it is rooted in psychological science, it is demonstrating efficacy and safety, and it's been co-created by subject matter experts for the purposes of addressing mental health issues.
This bot won't be widely available until it's tested more. Wright says with the tremendous shortage of mental health providers, human therapists need not be intimidated by their AI counterparts.
I don't think humans need to be concerned that they're going to be put out of business.
She says we need all the quality therapists we can get, human or bot. Kadia Riddle, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens for gardens and landscapes at garden centers nationwide. ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. From Subaru, in partnership with the Arbor Day Foundation, Subaru is distributing over 100,000 trees this year to grow greener, healthier communities for generations to come. Subaru, more than a car company. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Probationary government employees, typically those in their first or second year on the job, were an early casualty of the Trump administration's cost-cutting efforts. Today, the Supreme Court allowed the president to move forward with the firings of over 16,000 government workers who fall under this umbrella, but the court did not address whether the firings were legal. So what is the impact of today's ruling as unions and former employees continue to challenge the Trump administration? Moves. NPR's Nina Totenberg is here in the studio. Hi there.
Hi there, Juana.
So, Nina, if you can, just start with what the court did today and what the vote was.
Well, first the vote. Only two justices noted a dissent and would have allowed the litigation to proceed as is. The rest, presumably, signed on to an unsigned order in which the court said that the nonprofits that brought this case do not have legal standing to sue in court, because they could not show how they themselves, the nonprofits, were harmed by the firings. That leaves these thousands and thousands of employees with basically one recourse. They have to first challenge their firings at the Merit Systems Protection Board, which is the federal agency charged with protecting civil servants. And that's going to be very difficult to do if they have to bring individual challenges to their firings. It'll take forever and it'll be costly.
Okay, so if it's challenging to bring individual challenges to their firing, I wonder, is there a systemic way for these employees to do so?
Yes, the MSPB allows groups of employees to be certified as a class. So it's a class action suit on behalf of themselves and others who are in the same category of employee. And so far, there have been more than 10,000 such class certification requests since October. And the vast majority, of course, have been filed since February, when the Trump administration and its DOGE helpers began firing people. As I understand it from people I've talked to at the Merit Systems Protection Board, they think they can deal with all of these class actions by the end of the year, and that's the outside date.
Okay, but Nina, if we're talking about more than 10,000 appeals, I can just imagine the sheer number alone, that would create a really sort of arduous and difficult process. So how would the Merit Systems Protection Board even begin to start working their way through all of this?
Well, the MSPB has administrative judges in every region of the country, and it typically has its more senior and experienced judges make the decisions with respect to class certifications. And when I gave you the 10,000, that includes probably large groups of people who could possibly be certified as a class. And the judges' eventual decisions can be appealed to the MSPB board, as I understand it, but the judges' decisions become final in 35 days without some intervening action. And one other thing with regard to this, the MSPB board didn't even have a quorum until yesterday. And the two board members who were there for the moment, because the president's trying to fire one of them, they might well cancel each other's votes out if they were to take an appeal before the 35 days. Yeah. In any event, the law allows a relatively quick appeal to the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. You, like I, am learning a lot of things about procedural due process.
Sure.
And they get their day in court, too. And if the Trump administration doesn't like the outcome, it can appeal once again to the Supreme Court. Only this time, there would be standing. And, of course, all of this takes time. And unless the MSPB orders people reinstated relatively quickly, and even if they do, it's going to take time.
NPR's Nina Totenberg, thank you so much.
Thank you, Juana.
The U.S. has started scheduling interviews with some Afrikaners in South Africa. This follows an executive order from President Trump that offers the white minority group refugee status. That move has emboldened other groups in South Africa who are now calling on Trump to go even further and support their secessionist ambitions. Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg.
We shall build a society
in which all South Africans, both black and white, will be able to walk tall without any fear in their hearts.
President Nelson Mandela's inaugural address at the dawn of South Africa's multiracial democracy in 1994.
A rainbow nation at peace with itself and the world.
Then, as now, not everybody wanted a rainbow nation. Trump's return to power and his false claims that the South African government is persecuting white Afrikaner farmers has shaken South Africa to its post-apartheid core. It's galvanized many Afrikaners, the descendants of mainly Dutch colonists, like singer Steve Hofmeyr, who released this Afrikaner pride anthem earlier this year.
Our call to the United States government is a very clear message. Help us here.
Yus Strydom is the leader of Orania, a whites-only enclave of some 3,000 Afrikaner nationalists in South Africa's semi-desert Karoo region that was set up at the end of apartheid. But Trump's championing of white Afrikaner farmers has given Orania new impetus to a push for secession.
The only stable and sustainable future is recognizing us as a people. Now, President Trump already did that in his executive order by specifically referring to Afrikaners. The next logical step is to recognize a territory.
Though secession is wildly improbable, the issue has reopened old racial wounds. Fikile Mbalula, Secretary General of the ruling African National Congress Party, couldn't hide his anger when responding to recent reports that U.S. officials are proceeding with their plan to process Afrikaners who want to move to the States.
The refugee centers, that is just madness, that you can build refugee centers in a country as peaceful as South Africa.
There is no evidence Afrikaner farmers, who are still among the most privileged groups in South Africa, are being persecuted, as both Trump and his South African-born advisor Elon Musk have claimed. Now, the small Cape Independence advocacy group is heading to Washington this month to lobby the government to support its push for a referendum on whether the wealthy Western Cape province should secede.
Cape Independence is a desire of South Africa's Western Cape province, which is one of nine in South Africa and the one which contains Cape Town, to break away from the Republic of South Africa and to form its own democratic state.
The fringe group's co-founder, Phil Craig, says he believes an independent Western Cape, or what's been dubbed Cape Exit in a nod to Brexit, would be more sympathetic to the Trump administration's foreign policy goals than the current South African government.
The Western Cape would be far better off as an independent country. They're facing many challenges, and these include chronically low economic growth, chronically high unemployment, 142 race-based policies.
But South African President Cyril Ramaphosa takes, quote, a very dim view of secessionist groups, said his spokesman Vincent Magwenya.
These groups who are heading to Washington do not represent the majority of South Africans, whether it's the Orania movement or it's AfriForum or it's this Cape Independence advocacy.
Most citizens, he says, still believe in Mandela's dream. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
This is NPR News. On the campaign trail, Donald Trump made cognitive testing an issue, even after President Biden dropped out.
We should have cognitive tests for anybody that runs for president.
But how much will President Trump share about his fitness now? We'll listen to how he and his doctors have talked about his health. That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News. It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ilse Chang. Jennifer Weiner's new novel explores the relationship between two estranged sisters who were once bandmates.
With sisters, with friendships, certainly with mothers and daughters, there's a lot of nuance there.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. The Supreme Court has weighed in on the firings of thousands of probationary federal workers by the Trump administration. Justices on the high court pausing a decision today by a lower court that required the administration to reinstate roughly 16,000 employees who had been recently fired en masse. That ruling marks a temporary win for the president. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports.
The high court determined that the nonprofit organizations that had challenged the dismissals lacked the legal standing to sue on behalf of the workers who were terminated. The original injunction mandated the reinstatement of the employees across six federal agencies, including the Departments of Defense and Veterans Affairs. The Trump administration argued that the lower court ruling infringed upon the constitutional separation of powers and that the agencies have the authority to manage their workforce, including the dismissal of probationary employees. That question is still making its way through the courts.
As a measles outbreak spreads in Texas, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has endorsed the MMR vaccine. NPR's Jeff Brumfield says that's angered some of his core supporters.
In a post on X, Kennedy wrote, quote, "The most effective way to prevent the spread of measles is the MMR vaccine. It's the strongest statement yet from the health secretary, who once ran a charity that tried to end school requirements for measles vaccines. Many of Kennedy's supporters oppose mandatory childhood vaccination. Mary Talley Bowden is a Texas physician who thinks children shouldn't get COVID vaccines. She says she feels double-crossed.
For him to say that was not consistent with what we were expecting.
The CDC says the MMR shot prevents up to 97% of measles cases and provides further protection against severe illness. So far, two unvaccinated children and one unvaccinated adult have died in this latest outbreak. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Tony Award-winning songwriter William Finn died yesterday. He was 73 years old. Finn was best known for quirky and at times highly personal musicals, among them Falsettos. From New York, Jeff London reports.
The Massachusetts native studied at Williams College and first burst on the scene in the 1970s and 80s with a trio of off-Broadway musicals centered around a gay, neurotic New York character named Marvin, much like Finn himself. Two of them were combined in 1992 as Falsettos.
I never wanted, I wanted, I never, never, never.
Finn won the Tony for Best Score. In 1998, he wrote A New Brain, based in part on his own medical struggles and near-death experience. And in 2005, his most popular show, the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Authorities say at least 60 people died when the roof of a popular nightclub collapsed in the Dominican Republic. It happened just after midnight in the capital city, Santo Domingo, where more than 100 others were injured when that roof came down nearly an hour after a merengue concert began. Crews still searching the rubble for possible survivors. Officials say it's far too early to determine why the roof collapsed. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America, From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump's tariffs have sparked reactions from all over the globe. Some countries targeted by Trump are retaliating with measures of their own. Others do want to negotiate. Meanwhile, stock markets tumbled badly before settling a little bit today. And there's been increasing pushback in Congress, including from some Republicans. Today, a bipartisan group in the House introduced a bill to limit presidential authority over tariffs and require congressional approval for them. It's similar to a measure introduced earlier in the Senate. Republican Congressman Jeff Hurd of Colorado is one of the co-sponsors in the House and joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, Elsa. Happy to join you.
Well, thank you for being with us. So as you've been watching these tariffs piling up, just give us a sense of what's been going through your mind these last several days.
Well, I think like most Americans, I've been seeing the severe economic dislocation. But fundamentally, for me, the issue that it raises is who has the authority when it comes to this issue of tariffs. And from my perspective, the Constitution, specifically Article 1, Section 8, is very clear that tariff responsibility lies with Congress in Article 1 of the Constitution. And I think that's something that this bill seeks to restore and clarify.
Okay, well, regardless of what the Constitution says or how you interpret what the Constitution says, what are you hearing from your constituents about these tariffs? What's been their reaction?
Well, I think most folks are concerned. They're seeing what's happened in the stock market and what's happening also a number of our manufacturers and producers in the district. My district is mostly Western and Southern Colorado, so we have a lot of manufacturing, but also a lot of ag and folks that are growing the food that we eat. And so they're concerned about some of the things that they're seeing in the market broader, and they're also concerned, like many Americans, about the scope and breadth of what we're seeing with respect to many of these tariffs.
Okay. The thing is, though, Republican leaders in Congress, including Speaker Mike Johnson, appear not inclined to act on this legislation. Like, they're saying that lawmakers should give the president and these tariffs more time. So how long is too long, in your opinion?
Well, I think the way that the legislation contemplates this is that Congress would have a two-month period within which it could review the depth and breadth of the tariffs and see whether or not this is something that would be consistent with what Congress envisions makes sense. You know, I know that tariffs can be a helpful tool in the toolbox for negotiations, but they can have major impacts on farmers, small businesses, and families in districts like mine and across the country. And fundamentally, I think that's why it's important that those decisions should be made with Congress having a say.
Yeah, but given that most Republicans in Congress are not speaking out against these tariffs like you are, do you realistically think your measure has any chance of passing?
I think we'll have to see. I mean, look, fundamentally for me, I'm a constitutional conservative, and this is not a political issue. And I would back this legislation regardless of who or which party is in the White House. And when I was running for office, I said the two things that I wanted to support were the Constitution of the United States and the people of the 3rd Congressional District. And I think supporting this legislation, regardless of how far it goes, is consistent with those promises I made to the people that sent me here.
I am curious, is it harder to advocate for your constituents when President Trump and his allies are threatening to primary their critics and unseat them in next year's elections? Like, how much do you weigh that?
Well, I try to control the things that I can control and not worry too much about the things that I can't control. I made promises to the people that I represent when I came here to uphold the Constitution and to do everything I can to look out for the people of the 3rd Congressional District.
Do you think you'll be targeted for supporting this tariffs bill?
I don't know. I think the president knows that I am constitutional conservative. You know, his agenda of energy dominance, growing our economy, reducing prices for American citizens, lowering what you pay at the grocery store, at the gas pump, and your utility bill, those are all priorities that I have. And as he has no more effective advocate in Congress than me for those priorities and the priorities that I think the vast majority of Americans share.
Republican Congressman Jeff Hurd of Colorado, thank you very much for joining us.
Happy to join you, Elsa.
Throughout its history, the United States never had an official language. That is, until President Trump signed an executive order last month making it English. It's a broad designation, but immigrant advocates worry that the order could cause real harm. NPR's Elena Moore reports.
On the surface, Trump's order wouldn't appear to change much. English was already the official language in 30 states, and most Americans speak it. But this order goes a step further than what states have done.
Declaring English the official language of the country is definitely a symbolic act. However, there are very concrete and what will be very tangible changes to federal language access policy.
Jacob Hofstetter is with the Migration Policy Institute, a nonpartisan think tank. He says Trump's order rescinded a Clinton-era measure requiring federal agencies to make their services accessible for people with limited English proficiency. That could mean providing interpreter services and translation support as folks navigate the court system, apply for Social Security, or access public health information. That said, Trump's order lifts requirements, but it doesn't automatically force changes at federal agencies.
It really remains to be seen the extent to which agencies will use the newfound leeway they have to provide less assistance.
So the question is, will they? Advocates are worried.
It definitely is sending the message that federal agencies and others no longer have to provide language assistance.
Marita Etcubanez is with the group Asian Americans Advancing Justice.
I think we can expect that they will follow the guidance of the president. So it might not be immediate, but I don't think we should wait around and see.
Advocates have already noticed small changes, pointing out that multiple agencies have trimmed or removed some of their language accessibility policies from their websites. But it's unclear what that means for current services.
We kind of feel like we're in this holding pattern where we're holding our breath.
Ben Carl is a spokesperson for the American Translators Association. He worries this larger order may tarnish some of the country's multilingual history.
Folks who don't speak English well are a vital part of the fabric of American society, and we fear that they will feel less included because of this.
To the White House, this order isn't about exclusion. Trump's deputy chief of staff, Stephen Miller, told Fox News that having an official language increases unity.
It promotes integration. It promotes national identity. Two words we shouldn't be ashamed of.
The new order comes as the Trump administration carries out a hardline immigration policy centered around reducing illegal immigration. Trump has vowed to carry out mass deportations. He's also said he'll end birthright citizenship for children born in the U.S. to parents without legal status, a right explicitly enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. Critics of his immigration policy argue that the English language order is part of that broader agenda. But as Kate Mencken, a professor at Queens College CUNY, points out, attitudes around language policy have a history of being in flux.
I think of language policy in the U.S. kind of like a pendulum swinging between these opposing ends of restriction and tolerance.
She says the politics of immigration could help decide which direction that pendulum swings next. Elena Moore, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. April 1st was the start of Sexual Assault Awareness Month. It is also the day that the Department of Health and Human Services fired the teams that work on sexual assault prevention. As NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports, the cuts were part of a major restructuring of the health agencies.
At advocacy groups and state and local health departments all around the country, April is a time to raise awareness about the prevalence of sexual assault, to do events, hear from survivors, and hold town halls with public safety officials. So for the staff that coordinates and funds those efforts to be fired from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on the first day of that month?
It just was like, really? Now we have no federal partners.
That is a health official in a Midwestern state. NPR agreed not to name her or specify her state because she fears retribution for speaking publicly.
Even in a red state, like, we've never had issues with, like, getting our work through. It's not a super controversial thing that like you don't want your daughter to be raped at college, right? Like that's generally like a well agreed upon thing.
Bipartisan laws passed by Congress require that the CDC provides this support to state and local groups. The Violence Against Women Act most recently appropriated $210 million to be distributed over 5 years for this work. Now, approximately two-thirds of the Division of Violence Prevention at CDC are gone, including the rape prevention staff. The Midwest state health official says in her state, the sexual assault prevention work is funded almost entirely by these federal grants.
We're in a holding pattern because they didn't end the money yet, question mark. But if there's no one there to distribute the funds, then like we're not sure if we'll have the money to actually pay for our staff, like if we'll be able to draw down our funds.
As an example of its work, CDC has helped fund and evaluate hotspot maps. A college asks its students to mark on a campus map where they feel unsafe and vulnerable to sexual assault, and then the school can take actions like adding lights to a dark stairwell or increasing buses at certain times to reduce overcrowding. Here's one of the fired CDC researchers who asked not to be named for fear of retribution for speaking to the media.
We have the ability, we have the infrastructure, we have the expertise to figure out what works to prevent sexual violence.
Lynn Rosenthal was HHS Director of Sexual and Gender-Based Violence under the Biden administration and has also worked as an advocate with the National Network to End Domestic Violence and as the director of a local rape crisis center.
Decades, literally, of work will be lost as a result of the Division of Violence Prevention being wiped out in this way.
She explains that the reason why there is a federal role in preventing and intervening in domestic violence and sexual assault is because states needed help with funding and program design and evaluation and asked for federal action. Rosenthal says that the CDC teams were invaluable to work happening on the ground.
They're the go-to. They're where we all go as advocates and government officials to learn what's working, what's not working, what should we try.
Since the rape prevention work at CDC is required by laws passed by Congress, NPR asked HHS what would happen, whether a new team would take over administering the funding and doing this work. In a statement, HHS responded, quote, "All statutorily required positions and offices will remain intact, and as a result of the reorganization, will be better positioned to execute on Congress's statutory intent." HHS did not provide details on how that would work. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ailsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Best-selling author Jennifer Weiner's latest book is about an early aughts sister act called the Griffin Sisters. The band is centered around two young sisters, Cassie and Zoe, and they, along with their bandmate and songwriter Russell, become this immediate sensation with huge hit songs. They make the rounds on MTV and Saturday Night Live, but that's before everything comes crashing down. Some two decades later, what happened to the Griffin sisters is a mystery, and that's when we meet the characters of Cassie and Zoe. They've both moved on, living totally separate lives, and Zoe is trying to shield her teenage daughter from the pull of stardom. I talked to Weiner about the Griffin sisters' greatest hits at her Philadelphia row house.
I just want to start by asking you to tell me a little bit of the story behind the book. I was doing a little research, and I understand that the character of Cassie came to you on a trip that you and your husband took to Alaska.
Yes. So there we were. We were talking about the people that we'd met and the conversations we'd overheard, because writers are fabulous eavesdroppers, and just thought about, like, a woman who I could picture her in my head sort of trudging around with, like, buckets full of cleaning supplies in, like, a giant parka with her hood pulled over her head and just running these Airbnbs, but, like, taking such care to, like, never let anybody see her, never have to talk to anybody. And I just started thinking, like, who is this woman and what happened to her? Like, why is she here? What's her damage? What's the trauma? What brought her to this place?
And so when you were conceiving of her, when you were there on this trip, did the music connection come immediately, or did that come later?
That came later. Like, I knew that she was creative somehow, and I knew that something had hurt her. And I think it was just like, you know, what if she was famous? What if she'd been, like, this hugely famous person who didn't want to be famous anymore, and, like, this was the farthest away that she could run?
Tell us a little bit about Cassie. Fill in some of the details for us.
Poor Cassie. Okay, so I was describing Cassie to a friend of mine, and I'm like, okay, so she's, like, a little bit, she's a bigger girl, and she's talented, like, extremely talented and very fluent in the language of music, but she has no idea how to talk to people. Like, she can't sort of, like, move through the world. And my friend is like, oh, so she's you. She's lonely, you know? She really, really wants to connect with people. The only person she's ever really connected with is her sister. And she sort of accidentally, as a favor to Zoe, ends up singing on stage, and she's got this gorgeous voice, and she can write songs, and she can play every instrument, and they become famous.
Your book kind of takes us through the story of Cassie and Zoe in multiple different times. We meet them when they're young, and we're watching as their rise to fame plays out. But we also get to see the different ways in which they grapple with the big question at the center of the book, which is what happened to the Griffin sisters. And as we were talking about, Cassie goes as far away as she possibly can. She sort of disappears into herself. But Zoe sort of does that too. She doesn't want any relationship with her former fame at the point that we meet her as an adult. And we meet her daughter, who is trying to figure out all of these big questions. Her daughter's name is Cherry. Tell us about her.
So Cherry wants to be a star. Cherry is a teenager when we meet her. She's just on the verge of adulthood, but not quite done baking yet. She wants to be famous. She wants to be a musician, and she's inherited a lot of Aunt Cassie's talent. She sings beautifully. She plays the guitar. She writes music. And of course, Zoe wants her as far from the industry as possible, because the industry has chewed Zoe up and spat her out and left her a housewife in Haddonfield. And in many ways, Zoe is happy, but she wants to keep Cherry away from this, but she doesn't want to tell Cherry why. She doesn't want to tell Cherry what happened to her, because I think that it's a really vulnerable thing to have to tell a kid that you failed at something. And also, you know, Zoe was the victim of a sexual assault, which she didn't call a sexual assault 20 years ago, because you didn't call those things.
We didn't have the vocabulary.
So she just has sort of written this awful violation that happens to her as just, like, a thing that happens in the industry, and this is what it does to young women. So she just wants Cherry as far away from that as she can keep her.
I mean, one thing that I'm still trying to untangle, and I don't have the perfect question for this, is you have this experience that Zoe lives through where she's the victim of an assault, and when she's grown up, she's older, the Griffin sisters have broken apart. But then juxtaposing that with when she first becomes intimate with Russell and the fact that she talks about pouring alcohol into his drink, that's such an interesting mm-hmm. tension of seeing mm-hmm. there's some both sides there that I'm trying to unpack in my head, because I've been trying to since I finished the book.
Uh-huh.
I can't figure out how to untangle it.
I wanted that to be kind of an open question, because it's really interesting. When does a seduction cross the line into something that is non-consensual? I think that women can blur those lines too. And I think that Zoe has just decided all's fair in love and war, right? She wants to secure her place in the band. She knows her talent is not going to do it. Do we like that about her? Do we not like that about her? I mean, I side-eyed her pretty hard when she's pouring that booze into Russell's cup.
And I think I was literally yelling at my book at one point. It's like, what are you doing,
what
girl?
Are you doing? Yes, exactly. But in her head, you know, in her head, it's justified, because, like, why didn't she get any of the talent? Why did Cassie get all of it, right? And I think that if Zoe were older, she would know that. She would understand it. She would think, I got gifts too. I got things my sister didn't get. But in that moment, she wants it so much. And she's just thinking, I will do whatever it takes. I will cross that line if I have to.
I mean, I think the beauty in so much of your writing that shines through in this book is the fact that everybody's right in some ways. Everybody's also very wrong in some ways. What is it that draws you to continue to construct these complicated women with relationships with other women?
Yeah, well, I want to write the world I know. And I think with sisters, with friendships, certainly with mothers and daughters, there's a lot of nuance there, because I think that most of us in our lives, you know, we're a mix. We try to do the right thing, and sometimes we do the wrong thing, and sometimes we justify doing the wrong thing, like, real hard. And sometimes time gives you that perspective. Sometimes another person can give you that perspective. But, you know, I want my books to feel real. I want my characters to feel real.
That was author Jennifer Weiner. Her latest novel, The Griffin Sisters' Greatest Hits, is out now.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Total Wine and More, for discovering something new, like a Cabernet or single-barrel bourbon. Learn more at totalwine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina, available to adults 21 or older. And from Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in...